I'm Sarah Austin Jeunesse, The Moth's executive producer and longtime host of The Moth Podcast. Every week, we share true stories told live and without notes by real people from all walks of life. Stories about disastrous haircuts, May-December romances, photographing Pluto, fighting for justice, and so much more. Some stories make you laugh, some make you think, and many stay with you long after they're told. Discover the power of story. Follow and listen to The Moth wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit villageofbedfordpark.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Celebrating 25 years, the Noon Business Hour on WBBM News Radio.
It's 12:03 on Wednesday afternoon, May 13th. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on the Noon Business Hour. I'm Rob Hart. The Noon Business Hour, sponsored by FinishingChicago.com. McDonald's is putting its name on the future home of the Chicago Fire in the South Loop. We'll cover that in our next segment. But first, on the economic front, wholesale inflation surged last month. Meanwhile, President Trump arrives in Beijing for major talks with his Chinese counterpart. We welcome in Andrew Bush, former Chief Markets Intelligence Officer at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission and economic futurist at AndrewBush.com, based in Charlotte, North Carolina. Andy, thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. Looking at that producer price index figure, that is the wholesale price number. Wholesale inflation jumping 6% in April on an annual basis. 1.4% month over month. Higher fuel prices are to blame for all of it. And what does this mean for you? How long will it take for this to be passed along to you, the consumer?
Well, I would push back a little bit on what you said. It's not all driven by energy. The services index accelerated 1.2%, and that's the biggest gain since March of 22. But you're right. Overall, energy is the big driver because of what's going on in the Straits of Hormuz. Energy prices, oil prices are significantly higher, and that's not changing. And there's really no end to what I can see is this war that's going on in the Middle East. So I would just warn people, this is the April numbers. They're going to be bad in May as well, and likely be bad in June, and really be bad overall for people who are driving their cars over Memorial Day weekend.
Now, let's examine the acceleration in the services index. As you point out, 1.2%, the biggest gain in over 4 years. And what was driving that particular increase?
Well, that's a great question. It's a little hard to tease that out. But I think when we're talking about services overall, two-thirds of the move was attributed to trade services. And that's a signal, really, that tariffs are starting to bite in. I believe those were still under the Section 122s that were out there because the IEEPA ones, the really big ones, were shut down by the Supreme Court. But I just want to warn people that, like, 122s were also somewhat shut down by the Supreme Court. But the president's going to roll out Section 301s, and those are going to be pretty significant as well. So there's really not going to be a lot of relief in store when it comes to the services index, because tariffs are going to be with us really through the end of the year and beyond.
Speaking of the president, President Trump arriving in Beijing with a cadre of CEOs ahead of meetings with Chinese President Xi Jinping, what does the White House and those CEOs gathered with the president, what do they hope to accomplish in China?
Yeah, that's a great question. We need, as far as the United States needs, we need access to the rare earths coming from China. But really, it's the magnets that are created with those rare earths. And honestly, China has about a monopoly on those. And just so you know, there's about 1,000 pounds of those type of magnets that are in our F-16s, by the way. So it's really, those are so significant, and they go into so many different things. And I think access to those is really key for a lot of U.S. manufacturers. I think the president is going to go there and try to beef up our energy exports to China, perhaps, certainly agriculture. But remember, the last time the president did these things back in during his first term, he had this plan that China was supposed to buy all sorts of goodies from the U.S. we only got about 50% of the way there, especially on agriculture. So I would just caution people about any, you know, great outcome from this. It should be kind of more incremental. And I don't expect any major announcement to occur. China's already pushed back against the U.S. on a wide range of things. It's ignoring a lot of the sanctions that the U.S. is putting on people that use Iranian oil as an example. So China's flexing its own muscle here pretty significantly.
Andrew Bush, former Chief Markets Intelligence Officer at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, economic futurist at andrewbush.com in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up, a major branding partnership will make McDonald's Park the future home stadium of the Chicago Fire.
For 25 years, we've made sense of your sense. The Noon Business Hour, News Radio 105.9, WBBM.
One of the world's best-known brands is joining forces with the Chicago Fire as the club's future South Loop Stadium becomes McDonald's Park. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Danny Ecker, reporter, Crane Chicago Business. Danny, thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. And this is uncharted territory for McDonald's. It has sponsored many a sporting event, but this is the first time it's jumped into the naming rights game.
Yeah, it's actually a first on both sides of the deal here. If you think about the Chicago Fire and what they've been seeking to do with this new stadium, it's, you know, open up these new revenue sources in addition to controlling its own space. It hasn't had that at Soldier Field. Didn't have that in Bridgeview. It was a stadium owned by the Village of Bridgeview. So now capitalizing with a big deal and a big name for its stadium for naming rights. And yeah, McDonald's, it is kind of hard to believe when you think about how prominent the brand is that it's not had its name on a major stadium. But this is a first for McDonald's and certainly a symbol or signal of its commitment to Chicago.
Yeah, you bring up a very good point, and that is McDonald's and the Chicago area have been intertwined ever since the 50s when Ray Kroc opened the first franchised McDonald's restaurant in Des Plaines, headquarters in Oak Brook for many years, now in the West Loop. But the current McDonald's leadership signaled that that relationship is not necessarily permanent. So this really is a big bet on the part of McDonald's on their future in Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen McDonald's. So Chris Kempczinski, I mean, he's been in the CEO role now for several years. And I mean, he's called out the city for issues with crime and issues that McDonald's, he says, has had, you know, with recruiting talent, in part because of crime. A few years ago, he was going public with that. But he's also, you know, pretty consistently said that this is they're long term committed to Chicago. And you know, this is obviously another bit of evidence that suggests that's true. And but yeah, it's also, you know, look, it's a big deal. It's interesting too. It's not like McDonald's needs a ton of, you know, new marketing, as we see a lot of naming rights partners use such a deal to kind of get a brand on someone's radar. They don't need that. It's there's all kinds of interesting components related to Ronald McDonald House charities and obviously something that maybe offers some perks and benefits for McDonald's employees.
The naming rights deal extends through 2040. And while the White Sox and the Bears continue to circle the tower in their efforts to circle the airport in their efforts to build new facilities, the Fire, thanks to Joe Mansueto spending his own money, they've broken ground in the South Loop. And Danny, here's the question that many a White Sox fan would like to hear the answer, and that is, where are they building this stadium on the 78? Is the soccer stadium in the center of the property, or is there room for a neighbor?
Well, it depends who you ask on the second part of that, but the stadium is on the sort of the northern third, I guess I'd call it, of the 78. Of course, 62 acres along the river there, kind of a long, narrow property south of Roosevelt Road. You know, if you look at all the renderings that the developer Related Midwest has had out about the Fire Stadium, there's all kinds of, you know, future phases that have a big empty site on the southern portion of that property that could accommodate something else. The Related has shown and gone public with their interest. The Sox have been interested in pursuing a stadium there. The alderman, Pat Dowell of the Third Ward, is not interested in it, thinks it's too small, it's not going to fit. Neighbors don't want that kind of traffic. But that conversation is going to continue. And of course, there's the, oh, by the way, Justin Ishbia, you know, the owner in waiting, I guess we'll say, of the White Sox, having his own vision and also being under contract to buy the Amtrak property across the river from there. So a lot of interesting things at play when you think about stadiums and the activation of that whole area along the South Branch of the river.
Danny Ecker, reporter, Crane Chicago Business, thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, families are rediscovering frugal skills as economic pressure reshapes household budgets.
25 years strong and still paying dividends. The Noon Business Hour, News Radio 105.9 WBBM.
Higher prices and economic pressure are driving renewed interest in gardening, cooking, and all kinds of do-it-yourself skills to help families save and stretch their money. Welcome in Casey Finn, founder of the DIYPlaybook.com based in Chicago. Casey, thank you for joining us today. And at one point in your life, you eventually turn into your parents or maybe your grandparents. I don't know how many times this happened to you, Casey, but you go to like estate sales or garage sales and you see these big book collections of do-it-yourself home repair, cookbooks for all sorts of, or for stretching out leftovers over the course of a week, and you thumb through it and say, who does this appeal to? Well, it turns out it appeals to people dealing with inflation, and that's us. And so, Casey, what are some just overall do-it-yourself projects that could really help you save money, whether it's doing more tinkering around the house like you, doing more gardening, doing more cooking at home? What are some really good places where you can stretch that dollar?
Well, I certainly cannot help on the cooking part because that's not my job in my house. Home, I've got you covered. So I would say let's start with some of the basics like cosmetic things, painting, wallpapering, swapping out a light fixture. These are all projects that are easily DIYable. You don't need to call in a pro, and that's a way to save a little bit of money.
And then even on the cooking at home front, you look at a restaurant bill, and for a family of four or five, you could probably feed that same family for an entire week at the grocery store based, you know, compared to paying the same amount for one meal at a restaurant. So you could say definitely save some money there. And then when it comes to doing stuff outside of the home, you don't have to necessarily buy a pro and just start doing your own gardening. What are some resources that can help you teach yourself if you don't even know how to operate a shovel?
Exactly. Yes. I mean, we don't need to turn to those old dusty books at the estate sales. Now everything is online. You can go to YouTube, you can go to Instagram, and you can watch a 30-second tutorial before attempting something yourself to see, hey, do I think I have the skills? Do I have the tools to try that out? And I always tell people, you know, if it's something that's safe, why not give it a try? Because DIY is going to help build your confidence.
And then over the course of your own your DIY projects and all the stuff that you do, you have to get tools, you have to get a lot of supplies. And how can you do that in an intelligent fashion? Because you don't want to go to the big box hardware store and spend $500 on tools in the name of saving money.
Exactly. I think asking neighbors if you can borrow before you buy yourself, you can rent things just for the weekend. It kind of comes down to looking, do I really need to buy this tool or can I borrow it just to get this project done?
Casey Finn, founder of the DIYPlaybook.com based in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today. Of course, you're going to hear her stuff on our air starting on Friday afternoon. Still ahead in Personal Finance Wednesday, retirement planners warn against hoarding money instead of enjoying life.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and the host of the Jill on Money podcast. Beginning, middle, or end of the year, it's always a great time to take control of your financial life. And the Jill on Money podcast is here to help. Your questions make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money and, more importantly, on your life. Follow and listen to Jill on Money wherever you get your podcasts.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Rob Hart. The Noon Business Hour continues, sponsored by FinishingChicago.com. Markets are mixed. Joining us to discuss today's action on Wall Street is Jeff Kilberg, founder and CEO of KKM Financial, based in Chicago. Jeff, thank you for joining us today. And despite the producer price index report that came in well above expectations, reigniting fears of an inflation pickup once again, it seems like investors are once again powering past the bad news.
No fear in the markets today, at least in the equity markets today, Rob. And we're seeing the S&P 500 having another new all-time high for 2026. This marks the 14th all-time high for the S&P 500. Up about 20%, Rob, from that March 30th when people were really trying to figure out the Iranian conflict. We saw a lot of investors flinch. The market went down about 10%, and here we are nearly 20% higher, 74.50 in the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ 100 also moving higher. And I want to probably say that the reason for today's additional little boost is that there's 17 CEOs that joined President Trump on Air Force One to go over to China for this really big meeting. And I think those 17 CEOs are probably going to come back with some form or fashion of a deal, which is going to be more gas in the engine as the U.S. economy is hitting on all cylinders.
Well, going from the 35,000-foot view from Air Force One to maybe the 50,000-foot view of the markets, and that is, over the course of history, Jeff, and you probably know this better than I do, you're better off being bullish about equities than bearish. And there was a great story in the Wall Street Journal this morning about the people who did predict the few times the markets really did crash in an appreciable way. And they dine out on that prediction for years, but you gloss over the fact that they predicted crashes in the years before and the years after. And you don't remember those because they never happened.
That's right. And I think Michael Burry has been able to predict two recessions 45 different times. So, you know, it's remarkable to see some of the shorts out there. But I really go back to, why was I bullish? You know, we talk about my Essential 40 ETF, ticker ESN. We talk about owning these blue chip names and owning Intel and FedEx and Freeport Macro and ExxonMobil. But when we look back in March, why we didn't flinch is because the U.S. economy and the earnings component, Rob, we are seeing earnings right now really trending at the highest we've seen in quite some time. This will be the sixth consecutive quarter of double-digit earnings. But just to put it in context for the listeners, normally on a 10-year average, year-over-year growth has been about 8.5% for the S&P 500 companies. Right now, we are trending at 27%. That's nearly 3 to 4 times the growth. So my point is that this economic engine that we have here in our U.S. economy, it's hitting on all cylinders. They're figuring out a way how to embrace AI. They're also figuring out how to become more profitable. So that in itself, that was the reason I was bullish. That's why we didn't flinch here at KKM Financial. And that's why we're kind of having a smile on our face today with the S&P 500 at a new additional all-time high.
Is there, does today's PPI number, though, really ramp up the risk of an interest rate hike in the near future?
That's a great question. And I think Kevin Warsh, who's coming in, he is the new Fed chairman, replacement Fed chairman Powell. I think he is going to have his hands full. President Trump certainly wants interest rates to go lower, but the data is not supporting that right now. One of the main components I think is going to be a driver in that is how much longer is crude oil going to stay above $100, Rob? And the longer that is, that longer that possibility of raising interest rates happens. But I don't think he has the ability to move rates at all. And I actually anticipate a rate cut in Q4. But there's a lot of moving parts there. And right now, we're not loving the fact that the bond market has actually been moving higher. Now, that does reveal growth, but the fact of the matter, the 10-year note is closer to 4.5% than 4%. That doesn't make everyone feel good who's trying to borrow money in businesses right now.
Jeff Kilberg, founder and CEO of KKM Financial in Chicago, thank you for joining us today. Coming up next in Personal Finance Wednesday, retirement experts warn too many retirees are afraid to actually enjoy the money they've worked decades to build.
Lunch money for all generations. This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
Hey, it's Personal Finance Wednesday. Retirement experts say a growing number of retirees are skipping experiences, holding back on helping loved ones, and hoarding money instead of enjoying the fruits of their labor while they are alive. Joining us to discuss is Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance and Retirement Planning at Morningstar in Chicago. Christine, thank you for joining us today. And when you talk to people who are very hesitant about spending their retirement savings, what do they tell you?
Well, what makes you a good saver can make spending very difficult. The psychological transition of moving into retirement and going into spending mode is difficult for a lot of people. People are also concerned about long-term care costs later in life, especially if they don't have insurance against those costs. They're concerned about having effectively a balloon payment at the end of their lives. And then, you know, we have longevity as an issue as well. And that's generally a good thing, but when it comes to your money and needing it to last, that is another challenge from the standpoint of getting people to spend appropriately.
And where does the 4% rule come in?
So it's a spending guideline. It's a decent rule of thumb. And so the idea is, if you're trying to figure out how much you could reasonably spend of your investments, the idea is that if you spend 4% initially, and then just inflation adjust that dollar amount thereafter, that has been a sustainable amount in many market environments over recorded modern history. The problem is it often leads to underspending because it's kind of built for a worst case scenario. And most retirement time horizons aren't a worst case scenario for the markets. They might be much better than that. So if you stick with that 4% style guideline, you may very well be underspending.
And I think we've had this conversation before that sometimes, you know, that 4% is average over the course of your retirement, from the moment you hang it up as a professional to the moment you tap out for good. And that is, you know, you should probably spend more than 4% while you're physically able to do all the things you want to do.
Well, that's the thing. When we see the data on how actual retiree households spend, we see kind of a go-go, slow-go, no-go pattern, which dovetails with what many of us have experienced with older adults in our lives. So the issue is, if you don't spend more early, you may never do it. So I think it's a really worthy piece of guidance to try to embrace those experiences early. Think about giving to loved ones a little earlier. When we look at the data on when people inherit money, typically from their parents, it's often when they're in their late 50s, early 60s. It may be really, really valuable to inherit money at that age, but oftentimes people's financial fortunes are pretty well set by that life stage. The question is, if you're someone who's retired, can you make an impact earlier with your loved ones by, like, helping with a home down payment or helping pay off student loans? Because getting launched, obviously, when you're in your 20s is a lot more costly than it was a couple decades ago.
What can you say to people who are hearing this conversation and they love the idea of going everywhere and doing everything and living life as you please, but they keep thinking that, you know, one of these days I'm going to need assisted living. I'm going to have to pay for the home, and they're worried about that, making sure they can swing that when the time comes.
It's a very rational fear. So what I think is a great practice is to look at the data on how much long-term care costs, and geographic locale makes a big difference in terms of how much you're likely to pay. And then look at the usage of long-term care, the duration. When we look at the data, it's about a year and a half on average that someone might need paid long-term care. So think about that amount and effectively kind of hive it off from your spending money. So you're not worried about it. You have the money invested for very long term, and that should give you a little bit more comfort with spending the actual investment portfolio, spending what you could reasonably spend from that portfolio, because you're not so worried about that long-term care shock.
Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance and Retirement Planning at Morningstar in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today. Join us at this time tomorrow for Technology Thursday. And still to come, as summer heats up, experts stress the importance of learning how to swim.
Cash, credit, debit, and totally free. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
As summer arrives and kids finish up school for the year, experts say learning to swim is one of the most important life skills everyone should know. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is John Murphy, director of the British Swim School in Chicago. John, thank you for joining us today. And normally on this program, we talk about advice that can help save you money. But in this segment, we're talking about advice that could potentially not only save your life, but the life of your loved ones. And John, in your experience, how many people don't know how to swim, even as adults?
So even as adults, the numbers are very skewed, but we've seen as high as 60% of even adults don't know how to swim, which is crucial for the adults to know how to swim, especially when they're watching the little ones in and around the water.
And then when it comes to learning how to swim and how to find a class that can give you those skills, what are some things to look for?
So you can look for anything. I mean, especially at the British Swim School, we start as young as 3 months. We think it's really important to get acclimated to the water very early, but it's never too late to learn. We're always around bodies of water, and it is a lifelong skill that we think everybody should know.
As someone who has three little ones at home myself and has been to many a swim lesson, either at the Park District or at a private swim school, shout out to Goldfish in Park Ridge. It's more than just doing several weeks of lessons before you can develop a degree of comfort around the water. It is in many cases a multi-year process.
Yeah, especially at our program. I mean, repetition is really key. You know, families thinking they can start lessons 2 months before summer season, you know, usually is not enough time. Now, every child and every swimmer is different, but, you know, we tend to teach, you know, the rollover and the float, and that's not learned right away because it's not something kids are doing every time. So I'd say repetition is key and definitely takes a couple months to start to learn all the skills necessary.
And then what are some of the benefits of signing up your kids for swim lessons as young as possible?
Acclimation. We want to get kids as used to the water as possible, and we don't want them to be scared of it. We want them to know what they're doing in the water. And I mean, that can even include bath time. You know, it's another dangerous time where, you know, even at the pool, you always want someone watching bath time. You know, these are really life lessons that we can use in a multifaceted.
John Murphy, director of the British Swim School in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour.
I'm Susie Welch, the host of Becoming You, a podcast where I help you stop living by default and start living by design. Listen to Becoming You wherever you get your podcasts.